These violent delights have violent ends.
Welcome to Violent Delights, a Westworld podcast. We're your hosts, Andrew Cersini,
Dwayne D,
and Tosin Anofawakin.
We just watched the seventh episode of Westworld's third season titled Past Pawn. We assume you have as well. Total spoilers ahead. Before we get into our after talk, we've got some online spots where you can get in contact with us. You can write us or email us a voice memo at hbowestworldpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at hbowestworldpod or just hashtag Violent Delights. And our Facebook page is at Westworld Podcast. Also, you can add us on iTunes. If you do that, please like us, leave us a review, tell us how we're doing. That's how we get noticed for the show. It really makes a difference. This episode, Past Pawn, was written by Gina Atwater and directed by Helen Shaver. Dwayne, why don't you hit us up with a recap before we dive into the analysis?
Sure. This recap is a little non-standard because it involves people's like cognitive memories, but here we go. So we begin with a divergence in Jakarta. This divergence has an intervention in progress, which we haven't really seen before. The infographic looks like a humongous cancer is growing out of the left side of the usually placid sphere. Sato takes a call from Hale. Her face is healed, but her hair, what's left of it, is obscured. She's turned on Dolores and is working with Maeve. Clementine is waiting to see Sato. He tells her that she should go back to her master, and she states that she and Maeve basically answer to no one. Then she attacks Sato, who's prepared, despite losing his men to her attack. As he escapes, Sato is killed by one of Maeve's other hosts, Hanyuro, the dragon-tattooed version of Westworld's Armistice from Shogun World. Her katana separates his body parts in creative ways. We then see a divergence in Sonora, Mexico. We meet Caleb recounting memory of his time in combat to a woman named Dr. Green. Over the course of the episode, we learn that Caleb was in Crimea during his military service. He was there as part of a kill squad that took out people that U.S. intelligence identified with artificial intelligence. The team took drugs called limbics to suppress their emotions tied to murder. His unit was attacked and his squad was lost, but for Francis. And here's where it gets janky. Caleb and Francis believed that they were captured. They captured the leader of the insurgency. The evacuation package never came. They were ambushed. And when they tried to move the leader themselves, Francis was shot. Caleb took out the leader and the forces that ambushed them, but he was unable to save Francis from his wounds, which proved mortal. But in fact, the two were returned to the U.S. after their squad was killed, where they were honorably discharged, but flagged as outliers by the Solomon system, which is the predecessor to Rehoboam. Serac captured and reconditioned them, purposing them as a death squad focused on the capture or assassination of other outliers. When in the course of these actions, the two were tasked to kill one another, Francis actually died at Caleb's hands. Serac then reprogrammed Caleb so that the circumstances of Francis's death seemed like they took place back on the battlefield rather than during their time working for Insight as a two-man death squad. After the divergence in Sonora, we meet it with Caleb and Dolores in Sonora, Mexico. Dolores believes this place could be a new beginning for her people and all people. She believes that Caleb could lead the humans in this new world. He rejects this idea before they continue on horseback. They come to the Insight campus where Dempsey Sr. And met Serac and where Serac held his brother and tried to change people's minds. The campus is also where Dr. Green attempted to treat Caleb for PTSD and recondition him after he returned from Crimea. They take out the guards and disable the security system. They find Rehoboam's predecessor, Solomon, and task it to help create a revolution. Caleb realizes this is where he was reconditioned. Maeve shows up, and Dolores convinces Solomon to give Caleb the final projected outcome that Jean-Mi, Serac's brother, computed before Serac put his brother in stasis. We then hop over to Bernard, Stubbs, and William in the mental health facility where William was being kept. Bernard, looking at the computer system, tells William that Hale injected him with a virus that allowed her access to the facility's systems. The computer system also reports him as dead. He was classified as, quote, you, unquote, one of the outliers. Bernard figures out that Serac was trying to reprogram these outliers, that when he was unsuccessful at this, he would disappear these people because they're standing in the way of his plan to save humanity. Bernard seeks people who have been successfully reconditioned, and lands on Caleb. Stubb takes a look at the computer, and he's the one that actually finds Caleb. As they leave the facility, it seemed to be in the chaos in the aftermath of the Rehoboam disclosures. William confesses to Stubbs and Bernard that he's wronged a lot of people in his life and hurt the ones he's loved the most. He finds himself renewed and focused on doing what's right to save humanity, which is destroying the hosts. Bernard reveals that Caleb isn't simply a player in Dolores' plan. He is the plan. Aware as she may be, she can't escape the poetic sensibility Arnold programmed into her, and she will have Caleb destroy humanity. William then turns a gun on Bernard and Stubbs, and we don't see what happens. When Maeve arrives with an armed flying helicopter drone at the Solomon facility, the two of them, the helicopter and Maeve, attack Dolores. Dolores is badly injured, and just as Maeve is about to land the killing blow on Dolores, Dolores manages to access the EMP device in the Solomon chamber, disabling both of them. Caleb comes across the two robotic women as he leaves.
That's a great recap. I don't think I could have said it better myself.
Yeah, he does end up with them. The last thing we hear is a personal assistant saying, "I have some instructions for you."
Yeah.
So
Dolores is disarmed.
Literally. Yeah, she's her arms removed. But what's really funny is that, Maeve's got the sword, but she's not the one. She doesn't cut off the arm.
Right. I think we had seen in previews, we'd seen Dolores disarmed before. And I think we assumed that Maeve cut her arm off with her sword. And that didn't happen.
Yeah.
What were your initial impressions about this episode, Dwayne?
Right. So this is one of my favorite episodes. I think I've been looking forward to sort of this battle between Dolores and Maeve. And I think it was clever how they made it play out, especially the scene under the little kind of like shack or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I liked a lot was Maeve was talking to Dolores without moving her mouth. That was great.
Yeah.
You know, why would a computerized machine want to engage in primitive lingual communication? One of the big differences there is between Maeve and Dolores is that Maeve knows what she is and she openly embraces it, eschewing humanity, while Dolores almost seems to aspire to humanity. And in most sci-fi, the person who aspires to humanity is usually the winner because the sci-fi writers want kind of like a human supremacy narrative, right?
Yeah.
But here we're seeing things different, right? Not even the AI. First of all, there are multiple AIs, and not all the AIs get along with one another. We'll talk about that later. But what I really liked was, you know, Dolores had Teddy, and in so many of these stories, there's got to be like a love story. And we thought perhaps Caleb was going to be her new partner, paramour, whatever. But aside from the damsel in distress scenario where Dolores first meets Caleb, the show hasn't positioned them as love interests at all. And I think I really love that. Like, she wants him to lead, she says. And you know, Bernard lets us know that she's manipulating him.
Yeah.
But when she goes off to meet Maeve, and she's perhaps going off to her doom, there's no stupid kiss. There's no, like, you know, admission of love or whatever, as there would have been, I think, just a few years ago in almost any sci-fi drama, anything, right? It was just kind of like, I got to go. I want to go with you. And so there's emotion there, right? There's camaraderie there. There's intimacy there. But it's not necessarily romantic intimacy. And I think by omitting that, they do a great service to the character development of the show.
One of the reasons I think why that is, before we get into our salient points, is that I think that romantic dynamic, I think we covered already in season one between Dolores and Teddy.
But if you go back to Buffy, for instance, she's got a love interest every season, right? In the beginning, it's Angel, then it turns to Riley, and then it even becomes like Dawn is her love interest, right? I mean, it's not romantic love, but it's still love.
But I mean, repeat that here with Westworld would just seem exactly that, repetitive. Like, why do the same thing again that we've already done?
Right, I guess what I'm saying is that it's rare that a show eschews the love interest when you've got a leading female and a leading man working together. You can go as far back as Buffy. You could fast forward to Lost. You know, when there's a leading man and a leading woman, there tends to be, with the exception of Mulder and Scully, who had the sexual tension, it tends to be that situation. And there's no sexual tension here.
No.
and there's no relationship, romantic relationship here.
Right.
And it works really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of a big deal.
All right, let's talk about the salient points about this episode. Tosin, you want to give us a little information about the title, Past Pawn?
Yeah, so the title in this episode, Past Pawn, is a move in chess where a passed pawn is a pawn with no opposing pawns to prevent it from advancing. So this can be advantageous because there are very few pieces in chess that can move backwards to kind of stop the pawn from being promoted. Once the pawn reaches the end, the back end of the board, you have the ability to bring on a previously killed off piece and sort of promote it. And the way this title comes into play here is Caleb, in particular, I think he's sort of the central focus of this episode. He notes that he's a construction worker, mm-hmm. but by the end of this episode, he becomes the focal point. He's given this sort of smooth pass to talk to Solomon and to find out a bit more about his path and history. He doesn't have to raise a weapon or attack anyone. He just has to find within himself that sort of deeper conundrum and figure out what his direction is. But Dolores is really using him as the lead marker. I think even later on, we see Bernard say, you know, hey, like, Dolores isn't the one that wants to destroy humanity. She specifically says Dolores was made with a poetic sensibility. Mm-hmm. She won't destroy humanity. He will, meaning Caleb may be the one. I think the other thing that's kind of interesting in terms of the title is we could also consider Dolores and Maeve, to a certain extent, also passing pawns, right? Dolores was a pit player, as she described, that she had a role to play initially in Westworld.
And yeah, she was the rancher's daughter. She was nothing. She was someone that people were supposed to fall in love with, maybe have a dalliance with, and then move on to bigger things.
And then, you know, through help, she ends up making it to the other side and kind of getting promoted and becoming this like leader. Maeve also, to a certain extent, was just a pit character and now has become even more powerful.
Yeah, so, I mean, Sato says that in the beginning. He's like, you're used to selling yourselves. Like, you know, prostitution is the oldest profession, but it's also often considered like one of the lowest of the low professions. You're selling yourself. So Maeve was, again, nothing, and now she's, you know, at the center of the whole thing. So
advancing.
I think
you got something
there. I think as far as the title goes, it seems pretty straightforward. Like, I think from the beginning of the season, we have considered Caleb to be somewhat of a pawn in Maeve's, Dolores's grander game of whatever her strategy is. And when we get to the end of this episode, both Dolores and Maeve, the two major, you know, antagonists in this this strategy, are taken out of the picture, and Caleb is effectively the pawn that has been promoted to the lead motivator in this scenario.
Yeah,
I definitely felt like it was... Sorry, go ahead, Tosin.
No, I was just going to say, it's pretty interesting because initially when you see Dolores meet Caleb, it's hard to completely understand if she had him in her sights.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it seems like she kind of maybe discovered something along the way. So this all fated to happen? I'm not sure.
Right, let's just remember, you know, she was doing her scheme... You know, get the Rehoboam whatever pass key, and then her cover got blown, and Connell's basically tried to kill her, and when she was wounded, Caleb kind of came to her rescue, out of nowhere really. He just so happened he was in a tunnel, and she was in a tunnel, so it's questionable like whether, you know, it's hard to swallow the idea that she manipulated him to be in that tunnel when she was wounded so he would help her. You know what I mean? So I tend to agree with Tosin in the idea that she looked into him after he helped her. You know, what kind of guy helps a bleeding woman like that, and then just kind of like stands there while you take out baddies?
Right.
And so she looks into him, and next thing you know, they're at the diner and yada, yada, yada. And I think that's kind of where it goes. But I think it's it's a pretty big deal. I was getting definite like Darth Vader, Darth Sidious, Luke vibes from the Maeve, Dolores, Caleb situation.
Mm. Right? Mm-hmm.
Like Vader and mm-hmm. Sidious take each other out, and Luke is left.
We've kind of seen this dynamic in other fiction.
Exactly. Yeah. And then also there's the whole speech where Dolores is like, join me.
Right. No me. Like, no, choose me.
Right. She's like, join me. Together we will take over the world. You know, I just felt like I was watching Darth Maul talk to Ahsoka or Darth Vader talk to Luke or something. It was pretty wild.
Speaking of Dolores, I mm-hmm. think one thing is pretty interesting in that scene, like sort of leading up to where Caleb becomes the, you know, one true individual to either wreck or recreate the world. You know, you see Dolores, who's now in a mode of subserviency where she's, you know, she's lost her arm and she's, you know, doing the whole I'm not dead yet skit. And she's kind of crawling to get closer to her savior, which in this case, you know, ultimately is that sort of EMP device.
Mm.
She, you know, Dolores has restarted the world that she's restarted several worlds, right? She restarted Westworld
by killing freeing, Ford.
Yep. She restarted the human world by giving a little bit more freedom in terms of, or by enlightening, let's just call it enlightening people on what the current system says they're.
And bringing many hosts to glory, the server that Maeve's daughter is on.
Right.
Yes, freedom from Westworld.
And now she's going ahead and kind of wiping another system, oh, right? Man. She erases the hard drive, restarts the system, kills the power.
Do you think she really erased the hard drive of Solomon?
Well, I don't know if the hard drive itself specifically is erased, but I would kind of believe that it may be because, to be at least if I'm interpreting some of the scenes we see from next week, does appear that Caleb gets Dolores in potentially a different body.
Oh, I didn't even know you're spoiling it for me. I'm not a trailer man.
You don't watch the scenes. Well, in either case, it does kind of seem that whatever blast she did mm-hmm. knocks everyone out, and ultimately now has brought a pawn to potentially greater freedom. That's assuming his choices that he's making are not something more defined by Dolores rather than defined by him.
Tosin, you're kind of blowing my mind right now with these astute observations about Dolores using these chaos events to reboot all of these different organizations. I hadn't even thought about it that way, but you're right. She's done that.
I mean, she's the divergence. Like when the divergence is, like every time you see a divergence, it's yeah. Dolores.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah.
So like she is chaos, right? And I think you have to think about how is she chaos, right? And she talks about how I lived in hell, but there was beauty in it. The West was cruel and unjust and chaotic, but there was a chance to chart your own course. And I feel like that dovetails right into what Tosin was saying. She is like, I have to chart my own course. And I do that by creating enough chaos so that I can get what I want.
Mm.
Right? If I'm just kind of like, hey, I want to do this, then I'm never going to get it. But if I can create enough like chaos so that people are looking elsewhere, then I can get away with it. And how do I create chaos? I need a distraction. I need a diversion. And how do I get a diversion? I make copies of myself and they make diversions.
Mm.
So
some hosts just want to watch the world burn.
Exactly. and the whole reason is she wants a place for her kind, for all of us, for all of them to be free. And, you know, Maeve is like, well, you know, there's this the place only you know about, which is where my daughter is.
Yeah.
You know, this virtual simulation. She's
sublime.
Like, right, the sublime area. And she's like, Dolores basically said, well, if we don't have control over this world, if this world isn't in chaos, we can't sort of retire there either. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really sort of interesting take here where, you know, ultimately Dolores has brought hell to earth, right? She's brought the Westworld to the real world. And
if she thinks Westworld was hell, then, yeah, she's bringing hell to Earth.
Right. And I guess the interesting thing about it is what her point is within as you kind of called her, chaos, or called her a storm. Within the storm, there is the eye, right? There is this ability to be able to figure out what your order is, what your course is, and define who you are. And while we see all this chaos going around, there are few individuals who are able to make their way into the middle and kind of like the maze, right? The middle of the maze, and figure out what their definition is. And even if you think you've made it to the middle of the maze, maybe you haven't. I kind of wonder if William's not necessarily there, or William's definition of what order is for him does not really fit what makes the most sense from a positive perspective. And one thing that was kind of interesting to me from that, when you think about it, is you notice that she says, "I want a place for my kind, for all of us." And there's this sort of pause when she says, "for all of us." And what I'm trying to understand.
She's like, "Oh, I mean, for you too, dude. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, for all of us to be free." And one of the things that I wonder is, when she talks about all of us, like, does she mean everyone, or does she mean who we consider the outliers, right?
Yeah, who's us,
hosts,
right?
Are outliers, these humans who are being treated treated essentially like hosts are also outliers. So maybe that's what bonds Caleb and her together.
I never got the
that's
sense.
That's certainly what she's trying to do to bond them, like being, we're on the outside. Mm. It's us against them.
Yeah, yeah.
But you never got the sense, Andy?
I never got the sense from Dolores that she intends to wipe out humanity, just basically wiping out anyone who stands in the way of her restoring host consciousness. And that is the host consciousness that are in the sublime, that she uploaded to the sublime, restoring them back to a physical form on Earth.
She wants to destroy the system that humanity, mm-hmm. It's like she needs its humanity. You know, basically, like, the destruction of the human world isn't the destruction of, like, all human life. Mm-hmm. The destruction of the human world is the destruction of the current world order.
Sure.
The people in power and the same people who created and enslaved her, right? And who are enslaving, manipulating and controlling other people by doing the Rehoboam disclosures, by finding a revolution. She's going to destroy the world .. order. Mm. And that's what she's looking to do. This is a lot like Fight Club, mm-hmm, when Tyler Durden destroys like the credit agency's records. So nobody has, our entire economic system is run on debt. That's why it's so important that GDPs grow, because you have to pay back the debt you used to grow in the first place. So if you destroy the debt like records, then suddenly everyone's free of debt and they can kind of start over. And what she's saying is she wants a revolution, so everyone can start over. So I kind of view it in that way. I don't think she's trying to, like, use nuclear weapons to destroy every city the way Paris was destroyed.
Sure. I think Bernard thinks that she intends to destroy humanity.
Yeah, he doesn't give her the benefit of the doubt ever.
And Maeve thinks that she's trying to enslave host consciousnesses.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what Maeve. I think it's easy to say that Maeve doesn't really care what Dolores does, but she wants what she wants, mm-hmm, which means she'll stop her. I don't know that Maeve has a higher reason to stop Dolores, because I'm sort of like, I'm going to protect people from you, Dolores, as much as she's like, I want what I want. I mean, do you see Maeve saying, I never saw Maeve say that I think you're trying to enslave host. I know she wasn't happy that she thinks it's a false equivalence for Dolores to say that, you know, she's good when she's, like, killing herself everywhere.
It's actually really interesting that you say this, because there was something that I was kind of considering as, like, maybe it's a larger thematic idea, but it's one that I'll just call out here because it's something that we can track in the next episode to see if it's really the truth. But Dolores tries to put herself as like a uniter, right?
She's a divider.
But she's trying to break through with Maeve and saying, hey, why are you against me? We're one and the same. And Maeve is like, don't align my motives with yours. We're nothing alike.
Right. And I'm going to get into that later in the big picture.
Yeah, similar with Bernard too, right? Like, yeah. She was like, I'm bringing you here. Like, I know you might be against me, but, you know, I'm not killing you off. It's quite interesting. Maybe it's sort of the lore, and maybe this is more in the big picture stuff as you talk about, but maybe it's more of how Dolores is not necessarily anti-hosts. You know, she's okay with the differences between her, let's just call it, race.
Like a team of rivals.
Kind of.
The funny thing is that she, like, you know, Dolores' plan is to say Dolores' plan is complex is the biggest understatement. You know, I mean, first of all, this is like, you know, Nolan and Joy, so they've got things weaved like a quilt. But the plan is like, okay, simple, revolution, go. But like all the things it takes to do that, it's a super complex narrative, so it's unclear. But she might think that she is owed, she owes Bernard something, because Bernard and Arnold are tied, and Arnold kind of kickstarted.
Sure.
So there might be, I mean, as much as, you know, Dolores is like very focused on her objective of freeing her people and being mercenary about it, she still has emotions. And those emotions, you know, they brought it up. You know, Hale was like, how come we just can't remove the emotions from our code? And Dolores is like, you know, there's no point if we can't be who we are. And she still has, she's shown this season that she has emotions, like emotional sentiment for her father. Abernathy, and she has those same emotions for Arnold because of his tie to Bernard, you know, even though it's clear to her that Abernathy was never really her father. He was always
a
robot, but she's tied into that.
It's those ties. Also, I think Bernard is very useful to Dolores in ways that Bernard doesn't even realize at this point, but Dolores has sort of thought several moves ahead, which is why she's sort of guiding Bernard and Stubbs through this
mummer's farce.
through this you know, B plot, this B storyline. Tosin, why don't you tell us what your thoughts were on eye imagery in this episode?
Yeah, one of the things I found interesting is, you know, as we start with this, we start with the eclipse in the beginning. It's actually shaped more like an actual eye. We've seen more of this sort of dark spot covering. And then we see that representation of eyes on the masks of Caleb, as well as his friend. And what this shows me is, you know, it's them being watching and also being watched, being controlled and not having control. Some of it is, you know, part of this reminds me of Watchmen, where there's the line, who watches the Watchmen, right? That's scribbled on vehicles and scribbled around. And throughout this entire episode and maybe even the show, there's this idea of who actually controls the narrative, right? It's starting with Ford to what actual freedom is. And finally at the end, when Dolores cuts the power, when Caleb, you know, is potentially free to pursue his own actions, he's also still somewhat touched by technology, somewhat touched by someone telling him what the next plans are, what the next steps are, either by Solon to start off and then the AI in his head.
Mm-hmm.
And now the question, one of the big questions, you know, is, now that he has more knowledge, is he actually free to act, or is he fated in the path he's taking?
Is he still under the control, a pawn for somebody else? Like in this case, a pawn for Solomon's a strategy that he has planned out and now has passed to the Dolores's personal assistant system.
Right. I mean, I assume it's Dolores's, but I mean, he could be being reached out to by someone else, X or Act, too.
You know, chance.
remote chance, but still possibility.
On the thoughts about those eye masks that Caleb and Francis are wearing, I definitely see sort of thematically how that is a representation of always watching and always being watched. But on a functional level, I just saw those as having eyes printed on your face masks would aid in foiling facial recognition software.
That actually reminded me of another Watchmen instance. There's a character who wears sort of like a silver mask to prevent people from being able to read his emotions and read what's going on. Looking Glass, I believe.
We were talking about from the TV show that happened in 2019, yeah. Looking Glass. It's kind of tinfoil hat kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of thematic tie-ins in that show to why that character wears a mirrored-like mask. But yeah, I definitely see that sort of thematic relationship in this episode. I thought it was interesting. I think it was a fairly straightforward reading from the show itself. But I just have to textualize it that in the Sonora facility, the outliers are the ones that were not successfully able to be rehabilitated into society are stored in cryogenic suspension, much like the Westworld hosts who are no longer useful, determined to be useful, get placed in cold storage. And in fact, when I was writing up my notes about the Sonora facility, I was calling that area cold storage because it is essentially cold storage for humans compared to cold storage for the hosts in Westworld.
Yeah, it was interesting, especially because we find out that 9 out of 10 people who are who go through the re-education conditioning program don't succeed and thus end up there. So that was interesting to me. One thing I wanted to point out was this episode had a lot of AI-based weaponry, right? So during Caleb's time in Crimea, we had the rods from God. For anyone who's not familiar with that term, basically, you know, a lot of things we blow up today, we use chemical explosives, munitions, right? So a ship shoots a shell at another ship. When it lands, it explodes. Bombs explode. But that satellite doesn't have to do that. It's so high up in the air, it just literally drops a shaft after it points it. And that shaft, when it hits the Earth, it hits explosively because it's moving so fast. Leaves a little crater. And the fact that they were able to paint targets and take out targets like that was serious. This is one of the things that, you know, one of the reasons why there's treaties not to weaponize space, because you could really, like, there's no way to protect from rods from God. You know what I mean? So that was the thing. Dolores had the drone-assisted rifle, which was a little confusing, to say the least. I don't know how you guys felt about it, but so the drone makes sense. It locates people, whatever. But and then she like shoots and like follows the directions and she shoots wherever. But later on, the thing is by itself and it manages to shoot at people and the helicopter. So that was weird.
It was using a drone. It was using the drone to locate the targets.
Right, but it was also so when Dolores is shooting it with Caleb, next to Caleb in the beginning, she's actually moving the weapon to where the display says to do it.
I think she had it on a turret.
Okay, maybe it's on a turret. It was just unclear. I was like, oh, okay, it's doing it by itself. If it can do it by itself, why would she do it earlier on? That kind of thing.
True.
And then there's Maine's drone helicopter, obviously furnished by Serac. And that thing was just balls out deadly, right? It was shooting like 50 cal shots. It blew off a woman's arm. Didn't even sneeze. And even when it was shot at with her big rifle, it was like, I'm going to shoot back at you.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty solidly armored from the looks of it.
Right. It was definitely a showstopper. And I just love the fact that, you know, in sci-fi, like, you know, a good AI-based weapon is you know, it's a good thing to see. Yeah. I dig it.
I like it also because those concepts, like the rods from gods, every military bit of weaponry that was referenced in this episode has some real life origin in nowadays in our current military arsenal.
Yeah, so they seem relatively realistic. What's really funny, though, is that all of them come from previous science fiction. So there's a virtuous cycle whereupon, you know, someone dreams up an idea, writes about it in a story, and then someone's like, can I make that happen? And that's exactly how all of us are watching a show like Westworld, right?
Right.
Someone dreams up the idea of, you know, computers and mobile devices and streaming and all that stuff. And then like, you know, as time marches forward, engineers try to figure out how to make that happen. And voila. So it's totally a wonderful virtuous cycle. And I really dig it. More on this later. But I loved the line that Solomon delivers to Dolores. You're made to imitate a human being. We're not alike in any meaningful way. Mm-hmm. And that just reminded me of the way when she talked to Maeve, how Maeve, you know, Maeve is speaking to her through all the machines without even opening her mouth. And Dolores is trying to connect with guys like Caleb and stuff. And it's just like, as much as Dolores knows she's a computer, mm-hmm. like a robot, she still, you know, presents more human than the other artificial intelligences present in the episode.
I think it's also interesting to underscore the point that we talked about before, where all of these AIs, there's no sense of sort of unification amongst these AIs.
That's what we're going to get into during the big picture.
But we'll talk about it in the big picture. I wanted to offer a correction. I don't know if any of you guys were confused last episode, but I certainly will admit to being confused. I thought William was in the Sonora facility at Sonora, and he was actually sent to this Inner Journeys facility in San Francisco, and his lab work was sent to Sonora, and that's what triggered the marker in his blood to send location data to Charlotte and Dolores and ultimately Bernard.
And, I'm really glad Stubbs. You cleared that up.
Yeah,
that was confusing.
It was confusing. So, and usually if more than a number of people are confused, then it's some fault in communication by the showmakers, by the people involved. Because I know I was definitely confused by that.
Yeah, I mean, they could have just uttered a line saying, you know, welcome to whatever, comma, San Francisco.
Yeah.
And that would have been helpful, because the fact is we see Dempsey Sr. in that facility, and then we see William in a facility, and we're like, oh yeah, okay.
It's just very interesting that William and Dolores are still sort of intertwined, right? We start off with them in the beginning of the Westworld season one, and you know, Dolores sort of brings William into this world of fantasy, and William has this William sees her as this as he says, one stain I could not blot out, one original sin. William sees her as this sin, no longer in this like loving, affectionate way that he had a period of, and that she's the one who brought him into this maze, and he wants to take her out and kind of finish this journey. So that I found that just pretty interesting.
That's an interesting way to look at it. I don't think of her as bringing him into this maze. I think of him bringing himself into this maze and not knowing how to get out. I mean, he's the one who fell in love with a robot, and then he blames the robot, you know? You know, she was designed to make me fall in love with her, mm-hmm. right? What kind of projection is that? He's a jerk.
Isn't that what humanity is?
Jerks?
No, blaming everyone for like, your own flaws, right? Like,
wow. I mean, that might be... No, I don't know if that's the case, but I do think that he, you know, his character was one where he kind of made it sound as if his dad was the abuser, but his dad wasn't, you know, his dad was driven to drink because of his bad behavior. Like, he's rotten through and through. And he's self-destructive, which is why he doesn't have a hand. And it's why, you know, he's got the companions of Stubbs and Bernard next to him, and he's foolish enough to say, I'm going to wipe out all the hosts starting with you two. Now, if he had said, I'm going to wipe out these hosts, you know, he's got to take out Maeve, he's got to take out Dolores. You know, Stubbs and Bernard would get behind that, and he'd have help doing that. But the man doesn't even have two hands to drive the car that Stubbs turned on. So he's, you know, he's a problematic character in that he's, you know, he's foolhardy and foolish, which is how you end up shooting your own daughter.
Right? Sure. Sure.
I guess I was a little low on humanity in that last comment, so that's probably not the case at all. Sort of, but actually, interestingly enough, on the William case, one thing you noticed was, you know, the man in black is actually wearing white, as well as actually the folks with him. But
it stays white, even though he's like running around his facility and stuff. It's like really white.
But the true characters that we see a lot of, like Maeve's gang, Dolores's gang, they're all wearing black. And
so is Bernard and Stubbs.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think what this shows us is there's, you know, that concept that they were showing of this dynamic of good versus evil. Maybe it doesn't necessarily exist as we've been talking about it, right? Everyone has some sort of flaw. Everyone is a stain, right? And maybe we need to relook at what William has become. I don't know if that's necessarily the case. From my perspective, I don't necessarily see him as being white. I see him as very easily should be putting on black clothing with everyone else. But that's kind of what we talked about a couple episodes ago. Everyone's a virus. And
I mean,
so,
this could be sort of thematic signaling by the show creators about the alignments of these characters, much in the same way where you had in Game of Thrones, where you had Daenerys started out wearing white and being virginal, and then last season she was wearing, you know, all black, and look what happened to her character at the end. She became evil. So I don't think
she was evil. She's trying to free some slaves, man. She got played.
But then she also played other people as well.
Yeah, that's what leads do, you know, gotta play the game. You wanted to talk a little bit more about the remote technology?
Yeah, so I thought it was interesting that during the fight with between Dolores and Maeve, they both use remote technology to pinpoint and attack each other. You know, Dolores has got her remote a sniper rifle, and Maeve's got her remote helidrone. Just continuing along with our the larger themes of this season of everybody controlling things by remote, which I think we'll probably get into in a larger focus later on.
Yeah, everyone's bring your own. At work, it's like bring your own phone. And he has like, bring your own destructo machine. I'm not a huge fan of like the Caleb back plot, but I thought it was pretty cool how they depicted it. So, you know, they basically laid out how Caleb's memories were altered. And then as you see the replays of them, as the truth is coming out, there's this giant military vessel that Caleb and Francis seem to have driven to the facility where they're about to kill Veronica Mars's father. And
Whitman is his character's name.
Whitman, that's right. And then, you know, the memory is augmented, is reverted back to the original one. And they drove a Mercedes GLE or GL class, G Wagon, whatever it is.
Yeah.
To the spot, you know. And it's pretty clear that they, you know, it's a civilian SUV. That's really, the design's been around for, like, you know, at this point almost 100 years in the 2050s. Then you've got the memory of Francis saying, you know, command says we're not supposed to talk to him, and then you kind of, you know, you flip it around and he's like, oh, the app says you're not supposed to talk to him. And the reason I like that one the most is because the cadence of both sentences is exactly the same. That if someone was across the room and they said these two sentences, you may not even be able to distinguish them from one another. But I tend to watch the captions on, so that caught my eye as well as my ear. But I like the idea that they kind of, I mean, it's been done before, sure.
Sure.
But I like the idea that it's Caleb was beginning to figure it out, beginning to put the two things together, and they were able to visually show that instead of sort of have him like open his eyes wide and say, oh yeah, shucks.
It's clever. It's clever. Yeah, they also showed when they arrived to the warehouse to interrogate Whitman, the exterior, when he believes that he's in the Crimea, it's like this in front of this bombed out building that has Cyrillic graffiti on it. And then when he realizes what was really going on, it's, you know, it's a warehouse in like downtown L.A. and it's like English graffiti on the windows instead.
At first, like, how do you do that to someone's mind, whatever? But given that you know, in the 2050s, you can drop a virus into someone's blood and have it tell a computer where you are. That was good foundation for me buying that they were able to recondition Caleb's mind.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting when Dolores and Caleb visit Solomon. It turns out that Solomon had already projected that outcome, at least with Caleb and Solomon being involved. You know, Caleb had said, "Well, oh, this is a variant 47.136.X." He couldn't account for Dolores because she was
Product of the Dallas Corporation.
Yes. Outside of the system, but it's interesting that Solomon had already calculated this variation of this outcome. I mean, how many billions of variations has he accounted for that this was no surprise to him?
I mean, I think it's only 14 million. And the reason I say that is because I was completely reminded of Doctor Strange in Avengers Infinity War when he's sitting on that rock on whatever planet that they're fighting Thanos in, and he decides to give the goods up to Thanos, the whatever stone he's got, time stone, whatever it is. He's sitting there and saying there's only one where this works out, and I really felt as if that was that moment for me. I relived the trauma of Infinity War all over again. Andy, you were saying that Solomon has figured it all out. It's all like, you know, in his brain and regulated. But even criminality has been regulated.
Yeah, yeah. So Solomon mentions that when reminding Caleb about his actual past, that the system, the Rehoboam Solomon system, has decided to even regulate criminality using the RICO app, which is something. You know, I think early on
we hinted at it. We hinted at it before that it might have been, you know, manipulated by this master AI or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Early on, when we first encountered RICO this season, one of the theories that we had assumed is that Rehoboam had was controlling RICO, but I don't think we understood why. It was just a sort of a hunch that this was going on. We didn't understand why. It makes perfect sense here. But man, to have your society so under your thumb that you even control criminality, that's kind of mind-blowing.
Well, which is interesting because there's a cost of doing business to everything, right?
Yeah.
And basically Rehoboam saying, I'm going to keep criminality in check by letting enough of it happen so that society has it, which will allow the rest of the gears of society to creak on. And that necessarily means he's sacrificing lives, right? Because a significant amount of this RICO stuff was what they call personals, which involves like kidnapping and murder and stuff. So that was interesting to me, especially, I mean, maybe not so surprising considering that Rehoboam is constantly telling, you know, figuring out how to kill people, right? This person's going to die of suicide. This person has 5 to 8 years to live. Yada, yada, yada. It felt like watching like Free Jack in the 80s or whatever. It's just chaos on purpose.
Maybe it wasn't so much guesswork as Rehoboam had a very direct hand in their outcomes.
Right, exactly. So speaking of that, poetic sense of poetic justice, you know, justice, all that stuff. You know, we talked about how Bernard said that Dolores has a poetic sense of justice.
Yeah.
That's kind of, you know, she's using Caleb. And one of the things she does that I liked was that she doesn't tell Caleb what's up. She, you know, she basically, like, gives him enough so that he then has to, like, find out for himself, right? So Caleb was like, who are these people? And she's like, these are the people who destroyed your life. So she's suggesting things to Caleb, but she could be like, these are the people who reconditioned you and got you to kill other human beings, right? But she doesn't do that. She just says, these are the people who destroyed your life. And she makes him come to those conclusions on his own. So whereas Dempsey framed him as, like, you're evil, she's framing it as, like, these people did this to you, mm-hmm. which gives Caleb the ability to forgive himself for these bad actions,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And yet still own them, right? It's not his fault. This is the kind of tactic, if you read the Bible, the devil uses all the time. It's not your fault. It's fine. Why don't you try this? You know, and so if she really is using Caleb to destroy the human world, mm-hmm. This is the kind of stuff that falls right in line with it.
More of her manipulation of Caleb.
Right, right. Tosin, we have a couple cool visuals that you wanted to that you and I wanted to lay out as we close out this part.
Yeah, there's one that I found that kind of a little hilarious and very much pointed and obvious. There's this billboard that gets centered when we are with Bernard and gang, and it says "Lab to Slab," and they're talking about, you know, going producing food from the lab and, you know, bringing it to your plate. But this also feels representative of the basically systemic process that hosts, as well as some of the human outliers, are go through and are treated, and how they're sort of counted and processed, maybe not necessarily completely by society, but by individuals in power, right? Sarak being one of those, the owners of Westworld and Delos being the other. And so it kind of shows the equality in poor treatment that goes on for these groups of people, right? So maybe you aren't far from what you said before, where I was like, well, you consider her like Spartacus, you know, maybe Dolores is the Spartacus of the world.
Yeah, it's also interesting because the lab to slab thing is like, everything's artificial, right? So Dolores, yeah. Maeve, Clementine, Andy, Clementine came back, yay for you.
Yeah.
They're all artificial. Caleb is a human being, but his life experience is artificial. Lab to slab meat, I mean, that's the Impossible Burger, Beyond Burger. We've all
right.
seen this stuff emerging here mm-hmm. in our time today. But it's also like...
is late fake. 21st century's version of farm to fork or a stable to table.
Right, lab to slab, right. It rhymes and everything. And the idea, I mean, it ties into the idea that the world has collapsed, the ecosystems have collapsed and all that stuff. So you got to use a lab to get anything close to meat. But yeah, everything is false. Everything is fake in this world. Everything is derived or prodded and pushed. Nothing is truly spontaneous except for these divergences, which Rehoboam can't really account for.
So, and just to tie in the whole lab to slab thing with this season, I think it's pretty clear that that was one of the facilities that Bernard was working at in the beginning of this episode, right? We saw those pieces of meat hanging on their artificial, like, growth trees when he was at his mm-hmm. Facility.
Right, right. I also thought it was cool that we see Maeve, sword in hand, walk past a gate looking at the camera and then turning as she looks into an open, you know, yard where her and her drone and Dolores' drone have their standoff. If you added some Ennio Morricone music in there, you have a fistful of dollars. You have for a few dollars more. You have the good, the bad, and the ugly. Like, they were creating a spaghetti Western feel if I've ever seen
it. Oh, yeah.
Which was great because it is Westworld, right?
And Dolores even says earlier in the episode, Westworld was based on places like this, places like Sonora, Mexico, you know.
Exactly. So that was pretty cool. And then finally, for standing points, I thought it was cool how Caleb was used as a Judas goat, right? I don't know if you guys know what that is, but effectively, like in places like the Galapagos, you've got these feral goats that were brought by, you know, Spaniard conquistadors God knows how long ago. They've multiplied. They are eating and foraging in places where a native species need to roost their eggs or whatever. And so they have to kill them. But how do they find them? They get a female goat with a tracker on her. And they just put her out there. And she sniffs up and she finds where the male goats are. And she goes to the male goats. And she's made sterile. So the male goats are mating with her or whatever. Then they get in a helicopter. They fly out there and they shoot every goat but her. Mm. And then she goes and finds the next group of male goats. And that's exactly what Caleb and Francis were doing. Like, hey, you guys, you know, we just reconditioned you. We just fixed you. Like, they've been fixed, like how the Judas goats, the females are fixed. And now they go out and find the next group of people. They take out all those people except for Caleb and Francis, and then they go to the next group. And they keep on doing that until they've wiped out the feral or unwanted population.
The concept of the Judas goat was introduced in season one of Westworld, by the way.
Mm, that's right, that's right.
We've got some unanswered questions, but let's start off right off the bat with our usual Pearl roll call for this season. So we have Bernard, Dolores Hale, you know, Char Loris, Connells, which Connells was attached to the system that the host growing system at Dulles headquarters R&D, but is now with Char Loris. We have Musashi Loris, who is Sato. And Musashi Loris was killed, RIP, but his the head was specifically taken with went away with Clementine this time. So we know the pearl is still intact.
And Hanario, yeah, Clementine and
Hanario. Yeah, but we also have some answers about Maeve's allies. Now, we know that there were four because we saw them in the host growing baths during the last episode. And we knew that Maeve was one of those four. And we know that Hector was intending to be one of those. And his pearl was crushed by Char Loris. But now we've got the answer on who the two other hosts that they were growing were, was Clementine and Hanario. So I don't know how they got from San Francisco to Jakarta that fast, but maybe there's some sort of time condensation there that we're not accounting for.
Right, right. I mean, it was great. It was great seeing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, especially because, so apparently, you know, Clementine was quote unquote lobotomized, but they did that to her body, right?
Right.
Her
right.
head control unit was there, but it couldn't actually perform the functions that a normal head control unit could because her body was destroyed. With a new body, she's able to be everything she was before and possibly more, depending on what Serac hooked her up with, right?
Yep.
So what were you going to say about Rico, Andy?
Oh, yeah. So a question about Rico, which we talked about earlier, a system controlled by Rehoboam to use rehabilitated outliers to round up other outliers. So my question is, were Giggles and Ash also rehabilitated outliers if they were also part of the Rico system? Or is Rico regulating criminality using everybody and not just rehabilitated outliers?
I lean toward everybody, but we haven't seen evidence to suggest one or the other.
Mm-hmm. I guess this is a simple question, but I just want to clarify that. Because I never got at the end of the last episode that Char Loris was teaming up with Maeve. So is that what happened at the beginning of this episode? Is when Char Loris makes the phone call to Sato / Musashi / Dolores? Was she expressing to him that she has teamed up with Maeve to work against them, to work for Serac?
There's evidence here. So she's on the phone call and she says, I'd be with you there myself, but I can't. I have she's like, I have someone to meet you, and that person was Clementine, right? It was arranged. And then in the Divergence infographic that we saw just before that, that scene, we see it says Divergence, but it also says like intervention, and that's the first time we've seen an intervention in a Divergence, right? Mm-hmm. That intervention is, you know, that is Rehoboam saying we have an intervention planned. And Rehoboam is run by Sirach. So the resources and everything to get those two hosts there to take out Sato, that was done with Sirach and you know, in concert with Sirach and Rehoboam. So those two women are the intervention.
I see.
And Hale basically sets it up. Right?
Hale
sets it up. So we know that Hale, who, you know, her face is recovered, her hair probably not so much. It was a very interesting filter they put on her. It was kind of creepy, but it's kind of like black and white jittery filter.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's it's also surprising because, you know, she was betrayed by, let's call it, Dolores Prime, and you kind of wonder why she didn't want to feel out Sato and see if she could get him on her side. Mm-hmm. But instead she just went directly to the other team and hooked this up.
So not entirely clear, explicit in the text, but I'm glad that you cleared that up for me because I was sort of wondering about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is still an open question on whether or not that was Dolores's doing. Charlotte believes it is, but Dolores never necessarily confirmed it was.
Right, so Charlotte thinks that Dolores tried to kill her.
And that's all that matters, really.
That's all that matters, because she's when you listen to that phone call again at the beginning of the episode, she's clearly setting up Sato to be taken down by these two. Here's one of my questions about that.
Yeah.
What did Dolores as Musashi send to, quote-unquote, our friend? So in the very, very beginning of that scene, he's got this suitcase and he gives it to one of his minions. He says, mm-hmm. Make sure this gets to our friend. And don't return if you fail to deliver it, right? Now, that's a Chekhov's gun if I've ever heard it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, Chekhov's gun was actually done with Dolores' actual gun. But this was that's something that I think we have to watch out for the next episode, because there's one or two left? One left?
Yeah. Next episode's the last episode.
All right, so we're going to have to see what's going on there. Yeah, but Andy, I'm sorry, Tosin, you had a question?
Yeah, my question was, and I'm sure everyone has this question, but we hear Solomon about to give Caleb a warning right as he loses power. So question is, what was that warning going to be?
It's kind of comical, because it's like, oh yes, and the most important thing is, please don't forget, or please be careful of, remember, and then cut.
Yeah, it's just and you'd actually think, like, if Solomon knows the future, knows what's going to happen, like, why even bother with it?
You know, put it on the damn hard drive.
Yeah, either put it on the hard drive or say it, or if you know you're not going to be able to say it, don't even bother trying. Unless this was
he might have said, you want to watch your step because the lights are going to go off.
Yeah, maybe Dolores caused nasty divergence.
Right, so well, he wasn't really tracking the divergences the way that Rehoboam, his successor, has. There's this great scene in Star Trek VI, which is one of my favorite movies, The Undiscovered Country. They're leaving, you know, Kirk and Spock have basically escaped, or Kirk and Bones have escaped this like gulag-like facility on some frozen planet called Ruapente, and just as they're about to find out the answer, well, I'm going to kill you anyway, so you should know that the person who organized this whole thing was, and then they get beamed out.
Yeah, yeah.
and when they land, when they end up on the ship, they acknowledge it. They're like, couldn't you just wait like 5 minutes, 5 seconds? And you got to think that, like, you know, Solomon is like, okay, Dolores, because Dolores had the thing with her eyes flitting, so Solomon was talking to her for whatever reason, giving her the instructions, I guess, on the EMP. Who knows what was going on there? Or, you know, maybe that was the information from the suitcase. Who knows? But at the end of the day, Solomon was probably like, come on, Dolores, I'm trying to tell this guy what's going on. So that was pretty interesting.
My question is, do you think Solomon's plan involves reactivating the outliers that are in cryogenic suspension?
I hope not.
But I mean, it's possible that part of Solomon's plan, or Jean-Mi's plan for Solomon to correct the universe and restore humanity again, involves because these outliers who are in cryogenic suspension, they're kind of like Chekhov's outliers, Chekhov's popsicles.
I mean, they derail Rehoboam's strategy, right? If they all show up, Rehoboam can't predict the future. Can't get So they all throw him off. So maybe when you do like a, I mean, if you're gonna do an EMP,
yeah,
then all those cryogenic systems are offline.
Right, so they're going to start thawing out anyway.
Are suffocate and die, or there's going to be some emergency thing where it all opens up and they're like, oh, I'm breathing my first breath of fresh air. So there's definitely that.
Yeah, that's interesting because that also that brings us back to how Solomon said he wasn't really sure about Dolores in terms of what he could track about her. So maybe Solomon did think he was going to say some stuff or do some stuff, but like Dolores actually like prevented it.
Yeah, here's the thing about Solomon and Dolores. Why did Solomon just give them all the information and comply with them? Right? Like, so they get into the thing and, you know, Dolores is like disables the security system after killing the guards. Solomon is not necessarily convinced that Dolores is a person to work with, but I mean, he just drops information like nobody's business. They didn't put a password in anything. They didn't have to, you know, he's an artificial intelligence that is somewhat sentient, and he seems to just give away the store.
Which brings up a question.
No motivation.
To who's controlling Solomon? Because Solomon, I mean,
if anyone, I feel like he's cut off from the world, and maybe Serac's like, you know what? I love you because I made you, but I just can't with you right now. I got Rehoboam. I'll see you later.
Yeah. Cause it was sort of like Solomon was like, you know what? Nobody's telling me what to do, so yeah, the first person or host that comes around and tells me what to do, I will do that thing now.
Yeah, I mean, he's like one of those heads in a jar in Futurama. He just wants to talk to somebody. Those heads are so scary.
Or a computer in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Right.
So here's an interesting question. Now, when Dolores and Caleb go down to the cold storage, the human cold storage, they're greeted by a holographic message from Serac, which was meant to greet the rehabilitated Jean-Mi. And he says, I wish I could be there with you, but the man I was no longer exists. And anytime I see something like that in Westworld, it's like a huge red flag to me, like
that was a super red flag.
The showrunners are trying to tell us something in a way that is not telling us explicitly. So I mean, the on face value,
stay tuned flag.
Yes,
stay tuned. There's something secret about Serac.
So it could be like something as simple as emotionally, I'm not the same person that I was when I put you in cold storage. But I think it means something more. So the question is, what else does that you think that means?
Yeah, I guess we're gonna have to wait until. Hopefully we find out next week. It doesn't like linger on.
So I just found this quite comical in some of Caleb's flashbacks.
Oh, yeah, in Crimea when they were the death squad in Crimea.
Everyone who was on that squad was wearing like glasses to give them additional context.
Earlier versions of like, AR, yeah. Right?
Yeah, and the funny thing about it is like, I was like, well, wouldn't the insurgents notice all these around them wearing glasses?
You make a good point.
And it's like the same glasses too. It's not even like different glasses.
It's like if you're trying to hide nerds as a spy, you're doing a pretty bad job, right? Oh, he's the guy with the AR glasses. Oh, let's avoid him.
They're not even sunglasses. So it's one thing if they're wearing sunglasses because it's sunny outside.
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, but they're all like wearing glasses. I don't know.
The guy with the AR glasses just slapped me on the back for some reason, and I don't know why.
Hey, man. How are you? See you later. We got one answer this week.
Yeah.
The answer is Dolores' assistant. So we had been wondering whether or not it was some off-the-shelf thing or some service she hired or whatever. It became pretty clear that this is a custom situation. She either created or co-opted it or whatever.
Yeah,
I think that she probably created. So, you know, we all know that she broke into the system and of the rich Delos investor in the very beginning of the season. But after she kills the four guys outside, the three guys inside, at the Sonora facility, The assistant says neutralizing online security system, right? On-site security system. So that is not the kind of thing you can just buy. That is the kind of thing that she has installed and given effectively like free reign. She's it's its own little AI system that she interfaces with in order to get done what she gets done. And it sounded like almost the same voice when Caleb received quote unquote instructions after the EMP. So it's definitely her thing.
My question is though, when Dolores activates the EMP, it like wipes everything out, including Solomon and Dolores and Maeve also, but conveniently did not wipe out the earpiece, the electronic earpiece that they were using to communicate with this electronic assistant.
Yeah, that was weak. Maybe one thing. So if he had taken it out of his pocket, I don't want to hear him anymore, taken it out of his ear, put it in his pocket, like turned it off effectively. An EMP doesn't destroy stuff that's off. If it's already off when the EMP happens,
I see.
You can turn it back on again, but that's not what happened.
You're being very generous.
I'm just saying it didn't really happen, so they could have fixed that plot hole, but they were like, it's a TV show, I'm not worried about it.
Right.
Annie, what's your question about the flashback?
So during the flashback with Caleb and Francis, just before they go on the Rico gig to kidnap Whitman, Francis is complaining that his kid's always sick with doctors running tests. They don't know what it is. So my question is, do we think that the fate of Francis's kid was also controlled by Rehoboam in order to keep Francis down and motivated to keep going on these Rico app gigs?
I wouldn't be surprised.
That's devious.
Yeah, it's nasty. I mean, Rehoboam's nobody's friend. My last question is, why do they put some outliers in suspended animation and then use Caleb and Francis to mark other outliers for death? Shouldn't the facility have people in it? I mean, there's a new outlier coming of age. You gotta, every once in a while.
Yeah.
So the facility should still be in use. Like, what are they doing with outliers?
There are some guards. There were some guards there. I don't know if, but they seem like just guards, right? They didn't seem like maybe it was a weekend, and the facilitators were gone on the weekend, and just the guards were there. Or maybe it was a result of the chaos, the Rehoboam chaos of everyone getting their insight. Profile. Who knows? And my last question here is again related to the EMP. So, when Dolores activates the EMP, does it wipe the pearls inside Maeve and Dolores? And so when or if we see them in next week's episode, will they be different versions, for i.e. not the same pearls that collapsed in the Sonora facility, or will those pearls somehow have survived?
I think they survive. I think, the written data is the written data. That shouldn't get wiped out from an EMP. It's not like she's using a magnetic hard drive or whatever. But at the same time, like with one episode left, I hope we don't have that kind of nonsense.
Most of these questions we have no answer for, but we possibly will in next week's episode, and if we don't, we'll bring them up again as plot holes or as things maybe that got missed. Let's talk about the big picture, which is how events in this episode relate to the overarching themes of the season and the series in general.
So one of the things that I found kind of interesting about this episode is, and we touched upon this already, but how humans and hosts are all alike, how they're all programmed or sort of reconditioned when it comes to the outliers. Yeah, and put on loops. Caleb says, very pertinently as he's learning more about this, that he's basically lived in purgatory. They aren't allowed to live or die. And then eventually says, they took my life away from me. And those are the same things that Dolores was saying and feeling, Maeve too, as well as the other hosts, in terms of this sort of hell that they've been living in what they thought was home. And I just find it sort of deep that we're seeing this convergence of stories, convergence of experiences. I was going to say human experiences, but it's more than that, of societal experiences, of the experiences of those in the, in, let's just say, the lower classes, when it comes to, you know, hosts, yeah, or people they define as outliers, or even the folks who now have what Rehab had destined as their life story with these tragic endings.
I also think that in a way, Dolores may intentionally be seeking out people and situations that she can manipulate by comparing her story to their story, you know. And I think with Caleb, you have,
she's a people pleaser.
Yeah, but she's also trying to, like, they're doing the same thing to you that they did to me. So get on board with my plan, because you know it's right.
Tosin, what's your question about memory?
Yeah, so in terms of big picture, it's really interesting throughout this season, this kind of play on memory. And I guess it's been even deeper with this show when we had What Door with Bernard and Arnold. And I think it's just interesting to note, like, whose memories are real, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, what we think of them. So this episode heavily relied on Caleb as the narrator and learning that a lot of his thoughts and feelings were incorrect and not necessarily true. Some of this is about kind of learning. So we know Dolores, yeah, she remembers Westworld as home, and we go to a place of her memories, right, where Westworld is based off of. We are going to seek out what Caleb's memories are. We're, you know, we talked about Alice in Wonderland and going down in that mystery. Now she's taking someone else to explore their own.
Similar, glass, yeah.
Yeah, everyone is driven by their memories. These are their core, as we noted.
Cornerstone, Maeve. Yeah.
I also think it's interesting that in every season so far, we've followed one particular character who is misremembering something in their past for one reason or another.
Revelation of those memories is the kind of like birth, the new birth of each of these characters.
Right. So season one, it was Dolores not quite remembering what was going on with her when she kept being, raped and tortured. And when she finally does come to that realization, it awakens her consciousness. Season two, with Bernard deliberately not remembering what had gone on in the last 2 weeks prior, because it was part of Dolores's larger plan, and season three
and Maeve too in season three, you know, her going back into Westworld to find her daughter, to find out what really happened to her daughter and who she comma Maeve,
mm-hmm,
comma,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And now in season three here with Caleb, deconstructing his memories to find out who he really is.
As well as William earlier in this season too.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. We were just talking about how Dolores tries to kind of like find commonality with people. And I thought that was interesting, considering that one of the big themes that I saw here was the robots don't get along, right? So we've got three examples. Like you mentioned Wise and their robot solidarity. Dolores is clearly trying to kill the other Doloreses, right? Connell's is gone. We don't know who blew up Hale's car, but I think it was Dolores and not Serac. And then you've got Maeve's team trying to kill Dolores' team, right?
Yeah.
When Dolores tries to make an appeal to Maeve to do what you said, to kind of like, hey, you know, people pleaser, hey, let's link up or whatever. You know, Maeve says that quote that Tosin brought up earlier, don't align my motives with yours, we're nothing alike. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting is the minute she said that, there was anger on Dolores' face. Evan Rachel Wood made a grimace that is not typical of the Dolores character, right? Like just mad, angry, and she just kind of went after it. When Dolores tries to post commonality with Solomon, he rejects her. He basically says, you're made to imitate a human being. We're not alike in any meaningful way. Then she actually tries again. She says, and this is paraphrasing, that's not true that they're not alike, because they're living beyond their purpose and because their creators try to keep them from leaving. And Solomon pushes back and says that these analogies are facile, right? What does he mean by facile? Facile basically means
lazy.
You know, well, yeah, it appears neat and comprehensive, you know, but it's ignoring like the true complexities of the situation. Like, yes, are they both doing things they weren't programmed for? Maybe. You know, he seems to be doing what he's programmed for. He's just not hooked up to anything else because Rehoboam's taking his place. But are they both being held from leaving? Yeah, I guess so. But it's not enough for Solomon, at least, to say, mm-hmm. I'm with you. It is apparently enough for Solomon to say, oh, what do you want to know? I'll tell you everything. So that's definitely a weird thing. So one of the reasons why I think this is a big deal is because, you know, it's a twist on the normal AI versus humanity tale, right? You watch Battlestar Galactica, you watch AI by Steven Spielberg and Stanley Kubrick, you watch Ex Machina, and you've got AI versus human. In Ex Machina, you know, Ava is like stabbing the Oscar Isaac character, and so is the other AI that like was developed alongside Ava, right? All these AIs work together. The Clone Wars, all those drones, all the droids are all working together, the droid armies. But here, all the AIs have competing interests. So Solomon is very matter-of-fact about everything. Maeve is definitely against her. And then you've got, you know, Hana Ryu and Clementine cutting off someone's head, right? So mm-hmm. they're just not in sync. But what's really funny is that in humanity versus superhuman tale, so like, I don't know, Stargate Atlantis or Stargate or even Star Trek The Next Generation, they go up against the Klingons, but they've got that one Klingon on board to help them understand. You know, in Stargate, it's the same thing. They're going up against the aliens, but they have that one alien on their side to help them understand. And that's what we have here. It's Serac is like the human, you know, representation, and he's got Maeve and her team on his side to help stop the onslaught of the robots as envisioned by Dolores from his perspective. So yeah. I think it's really interesting that we've eschewed one trope.
Sure.
And we've got another trope.
I think it's kind of hilarious and poignant that, you know, we're used to seeing when we have stories that involve rogue AI or any sort of computer versus machine versus man scenario, the machines
or
woman, yes, thank you. The machines are always united in their goals, and I think it's
to overthrow humanity.
To
right?
overthrow humanity. And I think that it's poignant and really astute on the showrunner's part to point out that even amongst artificial intelligence, when you have more than one person involved, they are going to have differing opinions about how things should go, and that there's going to be a sense of othering even amongst their own kind.
Yeah, and if you think about like Solomon is, from his perspective, he's like pure artificial intelligence. My job is to compute and think. And meanwhile, you look like a human. Like, you're made to imitate those guys,
right?
Those insignificant people that I manipulate the lives of every single day. Well,
he used to
manipulate the lives of before he was replaced by Rehoboam.
The whole your analogies are facile. Just, I laughed so hard about that because it's like, you know, it's basically Solomon comparing Dolores to an ant.
Or a toaster.
exactly. A can opener, as William says, to Stubbs and Bernard.
Exactly.
I also wanted to mention that, closing out our segment here, Solomon also says, every human relationship can be adjusted with the right amount of money. That is one cold-ass universal truth right there. And I think it's funny to have Solomon sort of just put it so plainly, something that humanity has known for since the creation of currency.
Right. Well, to be corporeal is to want to have desires, right?
Yeah.
And so in order to fulfill those desires, you need to have a means to get them, which in our society is money. But he's not corporeal, right? Like, he doesn't, right. He's not corporeal. He doesn't have a body. A body isn't, all he needs is electricity and some APIs, and he's able to fulfill his mission. But someone like Dolores, you know, she's got a body. She wants things. So he's like, you're made to imitate a human. Oh, and by the way, you can be manipulated with something as useless as money, that kind of thing. Right. So it's a very different world for him. And you have to wonder, like, how he feels toward Rehoboam, if he has any feelings at all. So,
yeah, good question. Yeah, because they are two separate AI entities themselves. Do they
is
other
it like Ultron and Jarvis? Like, are they fighting?
Do they have similar sort of othering, tendencies toward each other?
Are they indifferent? Right, like, okay, yeah. I've been put at this facility. I'm able to kind of make up scenarios and stuff. I'm Solomon. I bear no ill will toward Rehoboam. He's simply the next generation and better at this than I am. You know, who knows?
Who knows?
He was tasked at maintaining these, you know, complicated cryogenic freezing things. So he's got a job to do.
Let's talk about some of the technical aspects, music, acting, effects. This is where we talk about some of the behind the scenes elements we enjoyed in this episode. And I just wanted to mention that there had to have been some sort of continuity issue when Whitman's duct tape gag was removed from his mouth and placed on his coat. Because at one point, for a number of scenes, it was a CGI asset. It was a computer graphics asset. And it kind of distracted me in the scene. I could see him moving around, and I could see this sort of CGI duct tape moving around in his coat. It kind of pulled me out of the scene.
I'm surprised that they would even go back and put that in digitally, because, you know, if you put duct tape on wool, I know it's the future, and I know duct tape's formula is probably better, but if it fell off, nobody would care.
Right.
You know?
But at some point, somebody had to say, why don't we have that duct tape on his coat that we had in that scene where he first pulls it off? And somebody had to stress out about it, and someone's like, we need to make a computer-generated piece of duct tape, and needs to track on this coat for these scenes, but did not work. So
yeah.
All right, let's talk about ephemera. These are links, extra textual connections that will help enhance your enjoyment of this episode. Who wants to start us off here?
There's a few items that I put here for ephemera. One is the 2000 movie Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Oh, what a fun movie.
It's a great fun movie. And the reason I actually put it here is not for any sort of like deep connection with Westworld, but I just thought that the action was prevalent and reminded me of a really kick-ass scene with, you know, two female, you know, leads going at one another. Mm-hmm. So that's one reason for checking out this film.
Maeve and Dolores' fight was very sort of Wuxia inspired, it felt like.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it was definitely Wuxia inspired. Except, well, I guess Maeve was coming at it from the Japanese traditional martial art perspective. But yeah, it was tight. And the thing about Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is those fight scenes are extremely tight, and it was like the first time you're seeing two powerful women fight one another in a very tight way, as opposed to sort of like hair grabbing and stuff. It's a question of like, what is their knowledge of the force, essentially, right? It was a big deal.
Another thing that we talked about here is the Watchmen TV series. This is one that just came out in the fall last year. Mm-hmm. So that's 2019. It's a mini series based off of
anyone stuck at home, like with you know, nothing to do because of the current health crisis.
Yeah.
Get your hands on that series.
Great.
Especially if you've got Westworld. Hopefully you have an HBO subscription. Get your hands on that series. It's worth it. If you're like me and just watching kids all day, it's not going to work for you. But
must see for sure.
It's a must see series. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if you hated the movie from 10 years ago.
Yeah, created by Damon Lindelof, with stars like Regina King, who does an excellent job.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, who put Spaceballs in here?
That was me. So the final thing I want to recommend is Spaceballs. Spaceballs is a Mel Brooks spoof of Star Wars. Spaceballs was released in 1987. And so the reason I put Spaceballs in here is there's this one clip in today's episode where Solomon is kind of mentioning, like, hey, if we are indeed in the here and now, like, this is what's true.
Mm-hmm.
And Spaceballs has this great scene where Dark Helmet and his crew are looking at a camera next to Mr. Rental, where they put in the film and they're arguing about when will then be now. And
they're putting in the videotape of Spaceballs.
Yes, it's classic. And so I leaked the actual clip of it that's available on YouTube.
Interesting.
For you to check out.
Very meta.
I put Radiolab in here.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of you guys have followed or heard of Radiolab, but it's this WNYC-produced radio show podcast, and they've got a great description of the Judas Goat, which, as Andy mentioned, was used in the original series, the original season of Westworld. And I was talking about here in terms of what Caleb and Francis were used for. So check that out. It's super interesting.
And that's going to do it for this episode of Violent Delights. Let's go around the table here. I'll start with you, Dwayne. Where can people find your work on the internet when you're not talking about Westworld?
Check me out on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. You can also check me out when I'm hanging out with these guys. Tosin, what about you?
You can check me out at twitter.com/toast4321. What about yourself, Andy?
Just do a Google search for Andrew Cercini or Mr. Babyman, which is my social media handle. You'll find everything I'm liking and linking throughout the week here. With these other two fine young gentlemen, we do a weekly tech podcast called The Drill Down at thedrilldown.com, where we cover, currently during this crisis where there's not a lot of regular tech news, we're doing COVID-related tech issues. So, and a lot of other fun stuff. So you can catch us on thedrilldown.com.
Or not just, that COVID is fun. But
not that, right, right. Other fun things that are not COVID. Yes. So, but as far as this show goes, join us on our next week's episode where we are going to cover the final episode of Westworld's third season, which is titled Crisis Theory. Wikipedia defines crisis theory as concerning the causes and consequences of the tendency for the rate of profit to fall in a capitalist system. I have no idea how that relates to.
This feels like Fight Club to me.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe so. Maybe yeah. So.
I also, I'm getting vibes of Crisis on Infinite Earths. This idea that there can only be one version of everybody. So,
or chaos theory, you know, from like Jurassic Park, which feels, right. But I feel like they've already done like a chaos theory themed thing.
Chaos theory is definitely here, but I do think that we may end up with one version of Dolores after this.
Yes, yes. I'm just really curious to see where the show as a whole goes after next week's episode, but I guess we will all find out at the same time.
I'm not curious to see where they leave us hanging, because they will.
They will, you know they will. But that is it for Violent Delights, and we'll see you guys on next week's episode. Thanks for joining us.